Bobby Lewis, bringing up the number one spot for 1961, tossing and turning. And so ends our countdown of the top R&B songs from 1961. It has been a pleasure and a privilege to be with you. Philip is on your radio, and we'll be back on your radio next week.
Online at WGXC.org. What? Tune in for a genre shakedown, all kinds of choice cuts of wax for you and yours to listen to. Dig it.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-eyes into here's how you cans. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com. Or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Pat of Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
If it's not De La Slow, and it's not WRMS. We're Catsing.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies. Once again, it's me, your host, Norman Douglas. The name of this show is Good Night, Norman. Tonight I'm going to read a story by Adolfo Bioy Casares, an Argentine writer, mentored by the great Jorge Luis Borges. This is from a collection called Selected Stories. And the translator is Suzanne Jill Levine, translated from the Spanish. This story is entitled Pearls Before Swine by Adolfo Bioy Casares. Casares. That Saturday morning in Montevideo, when I returned to the hotel to pack my suitcases and pay the bill, I ran into a fellow Argentine, an old provincial playboy from Rosario. He had discovered the fountain of youth in his flour mill, or at least he always seemed to look youthful. Youthful, but not young. The odd hair coloring around his temples made him look like a freshly painted popinjay. He assured me on several occasions that the secret was wheat germ. This man, I can only remember the syllables me and ni, and his Italian name, cornered me against a pillar in the lobby to inform me confidentially, "Bad news, man. The government is going to ban travel to Uruguay. It's a scandal. They do as they please. If it's constitutionally impossible, you can bet it will happen." His rough provincial accent irritated me. I asked if his source was reliable. "It sure is." He brought up the wheat germ again. Since I'm neither shy nor indolent, I left him standing there. Instead of checking out, I left the hotel, anxious to delay my departure from Montevideo, since this would be my last chance to visit. I could put it off for 24 or maybe 48 hours, give myself both a considerable and indefinite amount of time. But meanwhile, I wouldn't have to set a date. I wandered aimlessly around the old city, lingering at certain entranceways and corners. I wonder if such romantic impulses crop up spontaneously, or if it's just our tendency to imagine ourselves as the heroes of adventure stories. I ate lunch in one of the main hotels, took a long afternoon nap, and then hired a hansom cab to tour the beachside neighborhoods of Poquitos and Carrasco. When the driver tried to point out the Carrasco airport, I immediately ordered him, "Turn around!" Finding evening entertainment would be the challenge. I couldn't just go to the movies as if it were any other night. Besides, I'd already seen the two or three films that probably wouldn't come to Buenos Aires. I got out at La Pasiva Arcade. Since it was early, I could stretch my legs a bit and look at store windows before dining like a king at the Eagle. I'd also take a peek at the Solis Theater, from the outside, of course, since I already knew instinctively, let's bet that show was not for me. I wouldn't enter that hall, no matter what they were performing. Through the years, I've kept myself at a safe distance from most stage productions. Classical French theater, for example. Not to mention the Spanish Golden Age. He and I were more alike. The opera would have been silenced years ago. I don't mean to sound arrogant, but rather to speak with the humility of one who knows and respects his own limitations. I read the program. That night, they were performing The Damnation of Faust, a legend in four parts by Hector Berlioz. Instinct had not deceived me. It was some sort of opera, and I would feel as out of place in that theater as the rustic protagonist of Stanislao del Campo's Faust, which readers of Gaucho poetry may remember. But The Damnation of Faust wasn't an opera, so I was led to believe by an intellectual-looking man with disheveled hair. Near the ticket window, I overheard her encourage some man, a fellow victim, explaining to him, "Don't be afraid. It's not one of those corny melodramatic operas that make one cringe in horror. Tonight, you will hear a sublime oratorio, and, what more could one ask for, the music of Berlioz." Despite what I've said, I do not consider myself ignorant when it comes to music. And since I'm a bit of a snob, I even boast of being a music fan. Snobbery intuitively leads us down the prestigious path. I reflected quickly. Berlioz, doubtlessly exquisite, surely unforgettable. Just what I'm looking for to make this last night memorable. Besides, what a golden opportunity to enrich my culture. I knew I was on the verge of a fatal mistake, but I was unable to save myself. One might say that Berlioz's infamous Mephistopheles or something or other had caught me in its net. I tried in vain to protect myself. Let's take it slow, I thought, pretending to be casual. Let's see what time the curtain rises. 8:30. No way out. No time for dinner. This is serious. Man does not live on art alone. Our daily bread is a sacred matter. There's no doubt that the devil or his advocate had a hold on me. I immediately reasoned, if I don't want this night to seem like any other night, why not dine after the theater, following the prestigious tradition of famous playboys? You should have seen me at the ticket window, first waiting my turn, then buying my ticket. I don't know why it occurred to me that I was acting like a trained monkey. A good part of our behavior probably resembles that of domesticated animals. When I took my seat, the magnitude of my mistake became overwhelmingly clear. Who knows how many hours I would spend bound to the seat? What was keeping me there? The cost, in part, it was considerable but not exorbitant. I was too timid to return to the ticket seller and negotiate a refund, and I don't have the bravado to stand up, to the astonishment of the entire hall, fling away my crumpled ticket with a gesture of total liberation and walk out proudly into the night air. Wouldn't such an early exit seem like the act of a madman? Whoever has endured short stays in faraway cities will have discovered, as I have, that solitude, with its endless monologue and string of petty decisions, now I'll do this, now I'll do that, brings you dangerously close to lunacy. Excuse me. I had an orchestra seat in the middle of a row, so that I would have to bother a long line of spectators in order to exit. But since the seat to my left was empty, I was about to get up and leave when I noticed a lady in white approaching me from the same direction. The lady sat down beside me, and I muttered, "The die is cast. I'll stay." I then wondered how I had known that Berlioz was a great musician, a man in whom the music fan could have complete confidence. Of course, Cecilia had spoken about him to me. Cecilia, with her vast knowledge. She was as superior to me as the masters of the Italian Renaissance to the petty men of our times. We had been friends all our lives, though when the moment arrived for it to grow into something more, it somehow passed us by. And when it passes you by, it doesn't return, she herself explained. Nowadays, we hardly ever see each other, since we don't even live on the same continent. Cecilia's with her husband, a diplomatic attaché who was sent not long ago to a certain obscure post in Central Europe. Perhaps by now, he's been promoted to a higher position. He may even be an ambassador, ready for retirement and oblivion. Whenever they've recalled her husband to the ministry to do penance, he becomes an ogre because he's forced to put in a day's work, and as if this were not enough punishment, they pay him an Argentine currency. Occasions I abandon everything else and dedicate myself to Cecilia. That night in my seat at the Solis Theater, I arrived at the following conclusion. No doubt about it. Cecilia stands high above all other women. It's as if she were the only real person among cardboard figures. She is the woman of my life, even though we're only friends. Suddenly, I remembered what she said. Berlioz is a great second-rate composer for the ordinary man. But for the cognoscenti, he's one of the few real musicians that ever existed. Tuning and fiddling, suddenly I was struck by a doubt that made my presence in the theater an excruciating torture. Perhaps Cecilia had been talking about Gluck, and I had conceivably confused him with Berlioz, which meant that I was making a meaningless sacrifice. The memory of the devil knows what feud between Puccini and Gluck fans, only Cecilia spoke to me on such topics, deepened my suspicions. If there was no reason to admire Berlioz, Then why was I here? To suffer? To worry about not knowing whether or not I liked the music I was listening to? With the sane intention of distracting myself from such preoccupations, I took a look at my neighbor. Not only was she dressed in white, she had an extremely fair complexion. Or pale. Too pale. I know perfectly well that comments on pale women can be accompanied by a condemning grimace, but I'm tired of pretending. I'll confess, I'm not particularly refined. For me, such complexions represent a variation, one no less interesting than others, on Goethe's eternal feminine. Pretty Cecilia hides behind her vanity and flirtation an extraordinarily active mind. More than once she told me that sight and touch are two levels of the same sense. I can just see her spouting off with her charming pedantry. When men look at you intensely, you feel as if you're being touched. Though the experts never mention it, there's a subtle yet sure sensibility that warns us we're being looked at. My neighbor confirmed these truths. After changing position in her seat, she looked at me casually, perhaps not so casually. I was smitten. She was not only fair-skinned, but very beautiful, in a particular, strange, exquisite way. She was more capable, I believed, at that moment of provoking a sudden passion than a lasting love. After looking at her, I closed my eyes, perhaps to calm down. I imagined stately silhouettes on an Egyptian frieze. I recalled the head of a queen, reproduced recently in so many magazines, and of a movie actress who played the role of that queen, probably Cleopatra. Returning to the girl in white, I judged her beauty to be a bit bizarre for the woman of my life. But so unique and striking that if she passed me by and I lost her to the world again without ever having held her in my arms, without having seen and known her intimately, my grief would be endless. As I've said already, when we talk to ourselves too much, we're tottering on the edge of madness. I boldly undertook the siege of her citadel. I was going to play for all or nothing. If my neighbor gave me a cold glare, I would be finished. For when engaged in such maneuvers, I must look ridiculous. My only hope was that the recipient of this homage would consider it just and dismiss irony as an inappropriate response. Determined, I advanced upon the field of battle. Immediately, I pulled in the reins. Was she with the people sitting next to her? She had arrived alone, but she had been late. Was she part of a group? The mere thought of an incident was distressing. Believe you me, they were whispering among them. I again prepared to attack. Then another doubt crossed my mind. Maybe their seats weren't together, but there was a husband, a boyfriend, or God knows what, sitting in ambush in some unforeseeable part of the vast hall, and I would make an embarrassing faux pas, exposing myself to sarcastic looks, cutting remarks, or some worse, humiliation. Meanwhile, the performance had begun. There we were with the singing and the music, and I was the only one in the audience not facing forward, not watching the spectacle. Suddenly, I felt a fleeting confusion, a palpitation, a pleasing warmth in my body. I remembered saying to myself, "It can't be. What's happening?" The outline of a smile had appeared on my neighbor's delicate lips, which could only mean her recognition of my presence in the beginnings of a conversation. Conversation, the straight or winding path that could lead me to my goal. To make the next move, I had to wait until intermission, but somehow self-assurance or perhaps blind faith filled me with pleasant expectation. It was as if I were following the rules of the game because I knew intuitively that I was winning the game and that conquering those rules and obstacles would only increase the value of my final prize. I then noticed a slight movement of her head summon me, discreetly, secretly, to direct my attention to the stage. Stubborn, I obeyed. I didn't think it would be difficult to follow that order. It didn't take me long to realize my mistake. That chiseled, delicate, white face, enhanced by a slight touch of rouge, attracted my eyes involuntarily. Involuntarily, A new doubt startled me. Was it at all possible that I had before me a professional? Suspicions can always be easily confirmed. She's alone, I reasoned, because she's a pro looking for work. You may ask if I was attracted to her white and rosy face, to her deep blue eyes. Did it really matter if I had to pay to procure those delights? In his heart of hearts, every man is a survivor of the Stone Age, brutally, excessively vain, and filled with pride over his powers to conquer, seize, or hunt down prey, not to mention other vulgar analogies. But could a professional be so refined, I asked myself, looking at her lily-white hands? In a foreign country, what do I know? The intermission put a stop to my brooding. Our paths leisurely diverged, later to converge in a corner of the hot lobby. We spoke to each other so naturally that I was swept away by our conversation. Perhaps I was able to maintain enough objectivity to notice an occasional sign of progress, but not enough to pass judgment on my partner. Lady Luck seemed so favorable that I proposed, why don't we go out to eat? When? She asked. Right now, I exclaimed. Well, immediately she explained that the damnation of Faust was a work of great beauty. Please listen carefully to the third and fourth parts. They're about to begin. It was at that point, I believe, that the professional motif reappeared in my mind, accompanied by the memory of a ramshackle theater in the Plaza de Rio, which had been demolished some years ago. After reaching an agreement with their clients, those ladies did not stay around till the end of the movie, I said to myself. Of course, the movie, mostly pornographic, usually dealt with some secret disease, neither particularly entertaining nor stimulating, to be sure. Unlike the depressing screen, the premises, a filthy shed, seemed joyfully alive with movement, people scrambling for seats, producing a background music of muffled laughter and of something sounding like drum rolls. This recollection and all that it implied are the practical outcome of convincing me not to keep standing there like an idiot. I had to communicate, not awkwardly, but with wit, my intentions to the girl, at least to protect my pride. All I needed was to find some way of introducing phrases like, I bet you are not being a naughty girl. The girl's comments on the performance distracted me momentarily from my purpose. I had observations to make as well, but no matter how much I racked my brains, I couldn't find anything worth stating out loud. So I simply kept repeating, very nice, an incredible number of times. But I was not a man without words. Thanks to the fact that my voice was louder, I was able to impose my opinions and dominate the conversation. I honestly don't remember who said what, who, for example, pointed out the merit of the verse, or perhaps the situation suggested by the verse. I have seen him before in my dreams. I remember how perfectly the words corresponded to Marguerite's role. Mephistopheles had infused her with dreams in which she saw Faust even before she met him. But it all gets jumbled in the same distant nostalgia. I confused the passages I heard before and after the intermission, what we said in the theater, and what we said later and elsewhere on that extraordinary evening. Don't think for a moment that I lost my head or that I surrendered unconditionally. I defended myself to the bitter end. We tend to use the first weapon we find when we're in a predicament. I made jokes and comments that offended her, but without being explicit, so as not to ruin such a favorable prospect through impudence. When the young woman told me her name was Pearl. Wordplays based on names are crude, particularly for someone who believes himself to be refined. But it just seemed too much for a fair-skinned girl to be named Pearl. I'll even admit that the moment I learned this information, I was visibly shaken, which now seems incredible. Pearl is not a girl. To call her by any other name would be absurd and ridiculous. But again, I didn't lose my head. I took note of her way of speaking, which combined a foreign accent and the familiar vocabulary and cliches of an Argentine society girl. The performance ended, but it took forever to leave the theater because Pearl wouldn't stop applauding. I amused myself, watching such frenetic and doubtlessly significant activity. She explained that she didn't cry so that her mascara wouldn't run. You must like this pearl, I thought, to repress without the slightest resistance your irritation and not turn your back on her and walk away. At last, we left the hall, and I took my new companion's arm and boldly steered her toward the restaurant. Normally, I would never have let myself go so late on an empty stomach. As we walked leisurely, busy formulating phrases to define and praise the art of Berlioz, I was mentally eliminating complicated entrees that would require a lot of time. I decided to preface chicken fricassee with a simple cold antipasto, though I would keep an open mind to the maitre d' suggestion, especially if it could be served promptly and would be distinguished, of course, by its abundance. I know what happens when I get tired. I immediately need food or may faint upon the slightest delay. Just imagine how I felt when I heard Pearl's indifferent remarks, which were no less significant than fate's errors. Indifferent but indisputable. Though I know very little about women, I do know when I can and cannot accommodate them. At that critical moment, there was no choice but to repress my own personality and to be flexible, forgetting all needs and desires in order to exclaim with applause, "What a charming idea!" Pearl had said, "Where are you going? To a restaurant? What a bore. We had indeed made a 90-degree turn, and I found myself advancing in the opposite direction from the restaurant, but her hand squeezed my arm. And since there's always a sentimental youth lurking within, even when we are tottering with age, I could barely contain my grateful euphoria. Instead of entering the cozy dining room at the Eagle, we ended up in an enormous square. And who knows why, but I suddenly fantasized seeing the two of us as if from afar, a couple pathetically lost in open country. I remember details of that night in Montevideo as vividly as if I were dreaming them. As we fall in love, we experience wavering feelings which, in retrospect, we find alarming. Or is the danger of remaining outside an illusion? I've already surrendered that seductive game, the gradual conquest of woman, when she resumed her monologue. Go to a restaurant? Not a chance. They give me claustrophobia. After an abrupt silence, she then asked, "Are you one of those men for whom eating comes first, who have to eat a full course meal at dinner time?" She was describing me as if she knew me, but unfortunately, her tone was disparaging. She finished her tirade with the inevitable statement, "I can manage with a sandwich at any hour." Now please don't think of me as a misogynist if I sometimes make my little speeches against women. If once in a while I need to get things out in the open and off my chest, it won't hurt a soul. I adore women, but I can see through them. They are anarchists who disrupt our civilization. And taking care of the little things, this chaotic world would at least appear to have some order. Women are the great hindrance. They are the gypsies who don't respect man's 3 square meals a day. To whet my anger, I tell myself it's not for spiritual reasons that they fast, but for fear of gaining weight. I only need to remember another of these devotees to frugality, a genuine priestess of light eating. A genuine priestess of light eating, who for several nights kept me from ingesting anything more substantial than tea with lemon. And then I caught her one morning beside the refrigerator devouring a caramel custard pastry like a tigress. I am not a despicable hypocrite who denies the importance of food. Having said that, I must add that my unsatisfied hunger was not the only motive for my persistence. A stop at the Eagle, aside from nourishment, would have provided the ideal circumstances for an involved conversation, allowing us to get to know each other, to become acquainted enough so that our proposition to spend the night together would not sound inappropriate.
Without the restaurant, what path remained to guide our ship to a safe port? It seemed to me that my idea was best.
Shall we have a drink and go dancing? I said. Don't for a minute think I was anxious to take Pearl to one of those cutthroat dives, but a gentleman knows that there are times when he has to make the best of a situation. I was counting on the anticipated advantages, the infallible effects of alcohol, of dancing in the dark, the opportunities to grab, under the shelter of the aforementioned dark, those tidbits of olives, cheese, and nuts perched on the table. Since this suggestion was an unquestioned convention, you can understand my surprise at Pearl's response.
You're inviting me to a what? She exclaimed. What primitive charm. What a dear boy. I am tempted, but doesn't the mere thought of such a place give you claustrophobia? The mere thought of it bores me to tears.
You should have seen my anger. Only on the inside, of course. On the surface, I maintained an unflappable wide smile that caused cramps in my mouth. But this was not the moment to think about pride. I had to save the night, even though this woman's contemptuous exclamations were destroying all possibilities. After taking stock of the situation, I began to tremble. Was a tour of the city the only option? On foot, in the cold night air, or perhaps in a cab without destination, driven by a talkative chauffeur. Caught between the frying pan and the fire, I was paralyzed, too timid to propose a third option, which fatally came to mind and would eliminate plain and simply all other intermediate steps. I lacked the courage, and my vacillating suspicions about my companion's profession. I had definitively decided that I had been on the verge of a shameful error. My intuition was that any mention of the word hotel would turn me into a stranger, an undesirable, which would mean one and the same. Still, if I proposed a euphonious name, Ritz, Plaza, Carlton, Claridge, evoking images gratifying to her vanity, all but a certain disgraceful, unmentionable refuge, envisioning that place silenced me. I could already see the dilapidated den, trafficked by transient individuals clumsily embracing in worn sheets, attended by a repulsive scoundrel standing behind a counter and fingering paper money. How could one submit a lady to such a vile experience? Or does love conquer all, provided you give her time? Time intangible, indispensable, relentlessly rigid. You're right, I declared. Let's not go to the restaurant. Let's not go to the boite. Let's go on a diet. Anything you ask of me, short of leaving you now. To compose the next sentence, or to breathe, I stopped myself before explaining to her that we shouldn't waste time, that the time we had together for our, how should I define it, relationship or friendship was very brief, at the most 2 or 3 days. A sudden scruple, who can be sure with women, the fear of committing a tactical error, of providing her with the excuse to exclaim, then it's not worth it, kept back these words. I didn't regret my hesitation. She admitted, "You finally said something nice to me." Encouraged but perplexed, I asked, "Then where are we going?" She answered, "Wherever you want. Anywhere." "Anywhere?" I ventured. "Anywhere," she replied. Unfathomable reality then unfolded what I do not hesitate to describe as the culminating moment of my life, the most extraordinary night I have ever lived. I openly admit that not everyone is up to such great moments, which are both terrifying and magnificent. I myself took refuge in circumstantial distractions, and in the arms of ecstasy did not lose sight of the clock, measuring glory so that it would not last beyond 2 in the morning, closing time for the restaurant. In the depths of passion, in the most dizzying vertigo of interpenetration and erotic surrender, I did not neglect a shrewd detail. Not one word did I say about my imminent departure from Montevideo. What's more, as I avidly adored those precious hands, that lovable face. With deceptive lucidity, I realized it was no longer necessary for me to prolong my stay in Uruguay. The main point was to have achieved glory. Didn't one more day mean only a mere second day? I would fly out on the first plane in the morning. You will argue that if I continually withdrew into my mental calculations, this love must not have been that great. But you're wrong. In my memory, only plenitude remains. Though they probably existed, I would have to force my memory to come up with any imperfections. The worm that consumes each of us rarely gives up, however, and we more easily give ourselves over to impatience than to the great joys and sorrows. Life is too full of things for us to live it outside of our memories, which are not even illusions. So that, of those hours with Pearl, I also remember another defect, my hunger. Her continuous, subtle, gentle wearing me down filled me with a vague uneasiness which probably deepened the almost mystical aspect of that portentous night. Let nobody read this as a suggestion that the girl's charm did not suffice. With complete clairvoyance, I discovered that her discredited pale complexion, capable of igniting other censorious disapproval, was made for me, constituted the beauty for which my soul from time immemorial had clamored with vehement thirst. Later that night, I listened to stories about a distant country, a castle, a forest in Moravia, an English mother, an impetuous father who was a hunter, and also the revelation of secrets related to a Freedom League whose mission, or had I heard wrong, was to return to the past. May God forgive me. I persisted in making silent commentaries to myself. No sense in taking seriously, I said to myself, secrets revealed to the first guy to appear. It never occurred to me that I wasn't the first guy to appear, even less that my imperfect understanding would soon absolve Pearl of any possible blame. In short, I was left more informed about spacious sunny rooms like those in our country estates where that English lady had lived than about conspiracies and espionage. Poor thing, I commiserated, brought up in a castle. You meet me, and what do? But take you to a place like this. What's wrong with this place? She asked, looking around as if she didn't notice the suspiciously drab blanket, the crummy night table on whose rustic wood cigarette butts had left scars, the wall rich in clumsy drawings and penciled graffiti. I soon abandoned myself to the enchantment of her stories. Pearl spoke in a lively and humorous way, but in the light of her skin, colorless like the pelt of a dead fish, everything fascinated me. I still didn't mention it, but we had already left behind the hour of improvising and a refutable goodbye in order to get to the Eagle before it closed. I looked at my watch. Deliberately sacrificed my anticipated bouffe à la Rossini. The proofs of love could be measured according to each individual's idiosyncrasies. I'll insist again, then, that this was the most extraordinary night I have ever lived. The next morning, I flew to Buenos Aires. Whom did I run into on the plane? The Playboy from Rosario. In that narrow space cramped with suitcases, overcoats, and travelers, the Playboy and I bowed in reverent greeting, an implied recognition of mutual vanity. After touching his brow, my acquaintance asked, "How did it go?" "How do you think it went?" I began to say. Immediately, I glimpsed those curious colors, a flag of or Spumoni made of hair around his temples. I remembered the wheat germ, the reputation my opponent had as a playboy, and don't ask me why, I felt rage. To give myself the pleasure of rubbing in his face my latest triumph in his specialty, right then and there I gave him a blow-by-blow account of the previous night. I had plenty to talk about for the whole trip, including the passage through customs. It was unspoken resentment against this man, who, after all, was only defending himself the best he could against the ravages of time, that loosened my tongue and led me, without a moment's hesitation, to sacrifice Pearl, naked, figuratively speaking, and to exhibit her before outsiders, while in my heart of hearts a little voice repeated these words, "Where is your loyalty?" but who, after all, is loyal? Certainly not the good people, who are too weak. Perhaps some conceited snob, or probably no one. No, the worst part of those secrets revealed on the plane was the circumstance that for me constituted an invaluable apprenticeship. I learned to tell the tale, neither omitting in the process a melancholy glance over human weakness nor the comic note. Like the trained little dog who without rhyme or reason repeats his act, no matter what listener came my way, I would tell the story of my affair with Pearl. However, in this first experiment, I did not solely harvest praise. There was some little-known thorn which for a long time left its painful trace. The prickle caught me by surprise because it came hidden in a casual phrase. So if you liked the woman, why did you leave her? There's no doubt that the playboy from Rosario suffered from the incurable meanness of all masters, or of those who believe themselves to be masters. He was not about to tolerate the unavoidable lesson from a disciple without adding to save face some small objection. Wasn't his question a subtle blow below the belt? I recovered from a momentary lapse into confusion, and good luck had it that without losing a minute I was able to come back with one of those sayings that justify any and all conduct. In a quick counterattack, I asked him, "Don't the Spaniards say that he who flees love triumphs?" He answered in an explanatory tone that jangled my nerves. Well, until reaching the point of saturation in which we really can no longer stand her, a woman has not given all that she can. At this point, I realize it's difficult to escape, but if you're going to withdraw before, it's better not to begin. I'll say this much, that Spaniard of yours understands even less than I do. Even with his rough accent, the provincial playboy had the last word. Under the pretext of attacking our imaginary Spaniard, he stuck a thorn in me. But look, those who jumps right back, as I demonstrated that afternoon at cocktail hour when another Spaniard, this one a flesh and blood businessman, told me God knows what trivial anecdote about hunger in some remote village under siege during the Civil War. Raising my hoarse voice, I went on to declare, "Hunger, hunger is what I experienced last night in Montevideo," and immediately I told of my affair with Pearl. From there I went off to the club, to the baths. Under the showers, naked men were having uninspired conversations about the races. One of those typical old men who always seem so out of place at the sports club ventured to say, "Either I'm wrong, or the fastest man in the world was one in my time, a fellow named Paddock. If you let him go on, he'll talk to us about the real old days, about Botafogo, our old man," another warned. To beat any argument, I chimed in, "The fastest woman in the world is one named Pearl, whom I met last night in Montevideo." I slipped easily into the tale. I took every opportunity to improve it, rounding out the adventure, refining the comic effects. Let me note an odd detail. As time went on, I would insist less and less upon the brevity of the episode. If because of this I distorted the truth in some way, I want to stress that I did so unintentionally, not in any way moved to protect Pearl's reputation. I was distracted somehow into thinking that our affair had lasted more than one night. One might observe that if my memories corresponded to only two places, the Solis Theater and that house, there could be no room for delusions or errors. Through some unconscious process, or perhaps in my dreams, I must have fabricated these elaborations which raise the idol to a higher category, if only for my listeners. If you think about it, this is a customary practice. One afternoon in the Garden Hotel in Punta del Este becomes 3 or 4 days in one's memory with phrases like, "When I lived in Azul," we remember the week we spent in that mountain resort. There's another circumstance that will seem even more curious. Though I'd retired in a halo of applause after these speeches to my buddies, I did not feel happy. Some doubt stirred in my conscience. Could I, the enviable hero of this exploit, be the most wretched of mortals? By making up fun of Pearl, was I hurting myself? I believe that had I asked myself these questions then, I would have replied with an incisive no. I began to lose my self-confidence. I've told the story, but with vexation. as if falling back onto some shameful temptation. Every laugh from the audience, the narrator's prized reward, for some reason hurt me to the quick, lingering on like a sarcastic echo. Nobody keeps acting against one's will, however, so that after half a dozen expository experiments, I stopped airing my intimacy with girl. As I say this, for endless light years, her name did not spring from my lips. Oblivion did not accompany this monumental silence, however. Girl was in my memory, like a sanctuary, and I, repentant, hurtful, enamored sinner, went there every day to visit her. As for going off to the other side of the river to look for her, not a chance, because the government prohibited all travel. In times of a dictatorship, the whole population behaves a bit absurdly, like obedient students respecting the school teacher's rod. One night, 5 years later, at a table with friends in the Hunter's Horn, we were comparing yesteryear's Buenos Aires with today's when a cool pair of hands covered my eyes. I turned around and saw Cecilia. Our embrace was so spontaneous that, in the girl's words, a rather tempestuous proposition I don't deny, I immediately detected the consistency of the inevitable. When she said, "Where shall we go?" For women, others don't count. There are no difficulties. A couple is all that exists in the world, the one she's part of. Cecilia's proposition, inevitable as it was, caught me by surprise. Surprises are irritating. I was about to protest. What will the maitre d' say? What about my chicken? Who will eat it? Who'll pay for it? What do I say to these gentlemen? But at a table off to the side, I noticed her husband, who smiled at me weakly. And when I finally spoke, I substituted that angry interrogation with a single respectful question. What are you going to do with him? Well, my husband understands everything, Cecilia answered proudly. At a complete loss, I decided the best thing was to behave like a gentleman. Elegantly and swiftly, I declared to the boys who looked on suspiciously, "Gentlemen, tomorrow we'll settle accounts." I bowed gravely in my husband's direction, too gravely. Won't the poor devil think I pondered that to humiliate him by mimicking a mock condolence? Oh, that's his problem. Cecilia repeated her question, "Where should we go?" Home. I was great that night. "To your house?" she inquired, disconcerted. "Home. We're not going to wander hither and thither at this hour." "Okay," said Cecilia. I think she repressed a smile. I, meanwhile, made daring plans and reflected with extraordinary lucidity. I'll speak very little because the first dish I remember was tuna, and I may have bad breath. How's my room? Seen by a woman, horrendous, but less messy than usual. As soon as we arrived, I offered her scotch, put on a record, and escaped to the bathroom. I washed hands, teeth, face, neck. I soaked myself in cologne, and only out of modesty didn't undress, to return to the scene wrapped in a light and ample robe de chambre, with sleeves like wings and red dragons on a black background. My perfect complacency was clouded by an importune memory, the traditional feminine complaint against men who smell of toothpaste. A breath against the palm of my hand confirmed my fears. I put off, then, my attack and settled into a conversation. We spoke indifferently of this and that until the unexpected moment when Cecilia said, "In Prague, I met a girlfriend of yours. You know who? Pearl." Upon hearing the name, I reacted in the most incredible way. It was like suddenly being inoculated with fever. Right before Cecilia's eyes, I probably blushed, trembled, fell ill, perhaps even collapsed. I instinctively tried to appear calm, but I don't know if I succeeded. Cecilia continued. I kept meeting her at cocktail parties, meetings. Once I ran into her, I didn't lose her. She was always there beside me. Discussing Pearl with another woman was an insufferable sacrilege. Pulling myself together, I suggested, she probably took a liking to you. No, Cecilia answered. The poor thing only wanted to talk about you. I looked at her with gratitude, because I realized she wasn't going to attack Pearl. Meanwhile, I thought, I haven't been wrong about Cecilia. What sensitivity, what intelligence. And it amazed me that I had once... She was only a friend, irredeemably far from my heart. I spoke about the one who's close. Did she stay there and grab? She's not coming back here. She's under surveillance. They won't let her leave. They found out that she belonged to some revolutionary league or society. They detained her, interrogated her, and of course, they tortured her. According to her, she had a hard time of it, but they finally let her go. Perhaps because they didn't consider her important, or maybe to find out who she spoke to follow her and to get to the leaders of the movement. The poor thing knows that if she makes one false move, she's a goner. Let her leave the country. And what if I went? Her memory of you keeps her alive, Cecilia continued. I might go as far as to say that she doesn't care what happens to her, as if she was happy just to have known you. I wonder if I'm capable of valuing you enough. Well, do you think I should go off her? She told me a story that was too fantastic, that she knew you even before meeting you, because she had dreamed of you. She had loved you in her dreams, and that upon seeing you, she was not surprised, because she had waited for you so long, and finally you arrived. To explain anything was unnecessary. Why wouldn't she fall in love with you in one night? A decent woman who finds the love of her life does not debase herself with strategies and postponements. Those games are unworthy. A man, I assure you, understands this perfectly unless he's one of those old-fashioned idiots. Even an idiot has heard of love at first sight and knows that lovers always discover or invent precedents to show that their meeting was inevitable. I insisted. And if I went off to look for her, you'd have a hard time of it. The poor thing, crazy like all women, spoke of you. You don't understand this. Real men, keep to themselves. Not really. You should hear them in the club. Well, to begin with, you would be put into prison. Eventually, the embassy would intervene. But who's to say that they would finally let you go? You'd have a hard time of it. Fear is not foolish, but it is a pathetic emotion. Well, there you have it. Adolfo Bioy Casares, Argentine writer, his tale, Pearls Before Swine. That said, I don't really usually give out shout-outs or anything like that, but I feel like I should give one out to Towns and Keats. I feel like so amazed that he wrote me and said he listened to the reading of his tale, Zion the Profane, 2 weeks ago, and that he enjoyed it. That's about all he said. So I'm not going to get a big old excited over it or anything like that, but okay, I always read these stories that leave me like 5 minutes So the only thing I can think to do when that happens is promote my own damn self, because I don't really know anybody who's written any stories this short. I mean, there are short stories. I might have a book on it, but I don't have it here, like, handy right next to me. And also, I think I'm not supposed to say things like this, but I do have a book coming out, so I kind of feel like I could read something from it. I have to really say anything about how to buy it. You can't buy it from this radio station, but you can donate to this radio station, WDXC.org, a beautiful downtown community. Beautiful community radio in beautiful downtown Hudson of Combee County seat, and Catskill of Greene Counties. There's a pledge drive that I think happened in the week between my show. So you should go to wgxc.org/donate and pledge some money to keep this cool community radio on the air, because, you know, it's commercial free. You don't have to listen to me tell you why the Russians are bad or anything about artificial intelligence or anything like that, unless I feel like it. And if I did, it probably wouldn't be something that you would hear on a radio station that takes advertising dollars. But they will take your dollars, and they'll even take corporate donations. But all they'll say is that, you know, such and such corporation gave us some money. They're not going to be like, such and such corporation makes pharmaceuticals that have side effects like blindness, allergies to pregnancy, murder, insatiability, consumerism, and death. They won't tell you all those side effects or even what drug has them. They'll just tell you that that drug maker gave some money. But I don't think any drug makers gave any money. So this is like a poor example of like the worst kind of corporate funding. But, you know, I think if Raytheon gave some money to WGXC, I would encourage them to accept it. Anyways, trying not to editorialize while I look for this really brief story of mine, but I'm having no success. Not editorializing or finding the unnecessary tale. Gotta be a really short one, doesn't it? I read a really terrible story the other night at Lawrence Park here in Hudson. It's gotta be one of the worst stories I've ever read in public. And if anyone was there at Lawrence Park and actually was halfway sober enough to listen to me reading, I apologize. Everybody else is so drunk that they never even heard me say my name, which I guess is okay for if you're drunk. I mean, all writing is fiction, so I'll just read this, because I don't really have a lot of time. Like 2 minutes. Or less. These things are like still a page long. Okay, this is called Cigarette.